Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Vermont's school year wrapped up a little more than a week ago. Students, I'm sure, are already leaning hard into summer. Meanwhile, many educators, administrators, parents, and community members are still processing this past school year. From hotly contested school budgets to debates over the taxes that fund our education system, it has been a year. Later in the show, we'll get an update on the early childhood education system in Vermont with the head of the organization Let's Grow Kids. We'll also speak with a school superintendent and a principal about their school district's budgets. But first, the interim head of Vermont's education department is the target of a lawsuit that was filed last week. Zoe Saunders has faced unrelenting criticism since Governor Phil Scott first appointed her to the role in March. She is a former charter school strategist who moved to Vermont from Florida. Joining us today to discuss this lawsuit and more news from Vermont's education world is 7 Days education reporter Allison Novak. Allison, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the specifics of this lawsuit, can you remind us about Zoe Saunders and her credentials? Why was she such a controversial choice for Governor Phil Scott?
Sure. So the governor announced in March that Zoe Saunders was his choice for education secretary. She had been one of three candidates that was put forth by the State Board of Education. That's the way the search works in Vermont. The State Board does the search, forwards three names to the governor, and the governor picks one of those. So right off the bat, I think people were wary of her lack of experience as a teacher, as a principal, or superintendent. She's been none of those. So she started her career in education working for Charter Schools USA, which is a for-profit charter school management company. So this is a company that is a for-profit that runs, you know, dozens of schools in Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, and southern states. After that, she worked for the city of Fort Lauderdale as kind of a liaison between the education system in Florida, that area, and the city. And then she worked for just a couple months in Broward County as a administrator. She was tasked with coming in to lead an initiative to close and repurpose schools. And she only was there about 3 months when she was tapped by the governor to be education secretary. So, you know, the governor said, you know, I think he thought people's criticism was around her being from Florida and kind of the political atmosphere there. But other, you know, critics told me and said that it was really her lack of experience and her credentials that were the thing that raised the alarm bells for them.
And this was a really, really heated debate. I mean, I've spoken to some lawmakers who said they've never received more like personalized emails and phone calls about an issue than they have over Zoe Saunders's appointment this spring. And so she was appointed in March, and then this went before the legislature, and they voted not to confirm her, right?
What happened next? So the Senate had to vote to confirm her for her to be education secretary. So first she went to the Senate Education Committee. They did a little hearing with her. They voted on a 3-2 vote to recommend her to the full Senate, with Brian Campion, the chair of the Senate Education Committee, siding with the two Republicans on the committee to recommend her. But then on April 30th, when the full Senate had to vote on her confirmation, it was a 19-9 vote not to confirm her. And so, you know, I think a lot of senators spent a lot of time, you know, weighing the pros and cons, weighing kind of the feedback they were hearing from their constituents, and, you know, ultimately decided not to confirm her. However, just a couple minutes.
I remember getting these two press releases.
Yeah, after she was voted down, essentially, the governor sent out a press release and said, you know, she is going to be my interim Secretary of Education. And I think a lot of senators felt like it kind of flew in the face of the process, or kind of if the process says that the Senate has to confirm, but then the governor is able to just reverse that, you know, why is there even a process in the first place?
Mm. So the news last week, Allison, was that there is now a lawsuit about all of this. Who filed it? Who's it against?
So two of the senators who voted not to confirm Zoe Saunders, Tanya Vyavsky and Dick McCormick, filed this lawsuit. The defendants are the governor and Zoe Saunders. And essentially, it's about the balance of power, right? So it says that the governor, the allegation is that the governor basically went against the Vermont Constitution and state statute in appointing Zoe Saunders to the secretary, the interim secretary position, even though the Senate had basically said that they didn't want her, that they didn't confirm her. So, you know, they're saying that the governor circumvented the Constitution and that it's the Senate's job to advise and consent on secretary appointments, and he ignored that and appointed her anyway. Mm. So basically what they're asking for is that her secretary job is kind of voided, so that she is no longer secretary, and that anything that she did after April 30th, which is when she was appointed by the governor, is kind of null and void.
Mm. Yeah, I have a question about that one. So this would be that, as you just said, according to this lawsuit, any official action she's taken as interim secretary would be null and void. What actions has she taken that could be avoided?
So I reported a bit on a letter that she wrote to the superintendent down in of one of the districts in Windham County, basically saying that they needed to get their act together or the state could possibly take over that school or district. So she's definitely taken actions. However, it's still pretty early days. So it's only been, you know, what, 2 months or not even since she was appointed. So her whole thing is that she's doing this listen and learn tour. And that was supposed to start in June. But when I checked in with the Agency of Education, it looked like it was pushed back a little. So I think this summer and fall, we should be expecting her to be visiting different school districts and towns and kind of getting a handle. You know, she comes from Florida. She's not a, you know, she hasn't worked in Vermont education, trying to get a handle on what's going on in Vermont schools. And so, you know, she's been running the agency, but I don't know if there's been any really substantive actions that we can point to and say these are the things she's done.
Okay, no massive policies that would be repealed, anything like that.
No.
What has Governor Scott said in response to this lawsuit?
So he, in a statement after the lawsuit was filed, he called it partisan political maneuvering. And he also suggested that the timing of the lawsuit had to do with, you know, was the timing was a distraction from the yield bill. So he said that, you know, the reason that it was filed at this time was to distract from the yield bill, which is the bill that sets property tax rates in Vermont. Tanya Vyavsky said that that is not true, that the timing was based on the legislature disbanding for the session. And so, you know, he has characterized it as kind of a political maneuver.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about that, because Governor Scott and the Democratic controlled legislature have certainly been at odds this legislative session. I mean, just a week ago today, the legislature overrode 6 of his vetoes, which is a record. And in a statement about the lawsuit, the folks who filed it said that it's about standing up for the Vermont Constitution and democracy at large. But what role do you see, having followed this debate over the secretary for months now, what role do you see partisanship playing here?
Well, I mean, I think if you think about the process for picking a secretary of education, you know, the governor followed the process in that he did pick one of three candidates that were afforded by the State Board of Education. And, you know, something like this has never happened or hasn't happened in, you know, a long time, where the legislature has basically said no. Like, it's usually more of like a rubber stamp or like a kind of a formality, these confirmations. But in this case, you know, the legislature really stood up and said no. And, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how this is handled in the courts, because I think in a way, like, we're dealing with something that's somewhat unprecedented in here. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of how this suit fares in the court system.
Hmm. Allison Novak with 7 Days. We just got an email from a listener with this question. Why does Zoe Saunders want to fill this position when so many educators and Vermonters don't believe she's a good fit? And why does the governor want to go against Vermonters' wishes? That's a sentiment we've heard a number of times from listeners on our show when we've discussed this in the past. What do you think?
You know, I don't think we have a ton of insight into why she wants this role. I did speak with her before she was confirmed to the position, or not confirmed, before she was appointed to the position by the governor as an interim. And what she said was that, you know, she has family in Vermont. She really has an affection for Vermont and has been like looking to move here and to leave Florida. So, you know, that is kind of the reasoning she gave me about why she would want to come to Vermont. But I think there's still a lot of lingering questions as to, you know, why the governor thought she was the right choice. Because her credentials don't really align with Vermont's education system. Vermont is only one of maybe five states that don't have charter schools. And that's the bulk of her experience, is working in charter schools. So I think, you know, people are kind of wary about, you know, how her experience really fits with Vermont's education system at a time when we're really in crisis. Our education system is really in crisis.
Yeah, let's talk more about that. Specifically, the YIELD bill, which you just brought up. That's the annual property tax legislation that pays for schools. State lawmakers overrode Governor Phil Scott's veto a week ago. And this is going to result in an average property tax increase of just under 14%.
Yep.
And let's start with a positive here. That's lower than the initial projected increase of 18.5%. What changed to make that happen?
So I think the legislature was able to find some kind of money from different sources to kind of buy down the rate a bit. I also think that because budgets failed in so many communities, then they lowered their spending. And so that also made it so that the education fund didn't need to fund as much because the budgets were, you know, ticking down as people were going for second and third votes. But yeah, it's still a very, Vermont still has a very expensive education system. I think we're, you know, among the highest spending per pupil in the country. And we're not a very efficient, cost-effective system. And I think, you know, part of the challenge and part of the task that there's this Commission on the Future of Education that is going to be convening this summer. I think part of what is going to be they're going to have to figure out is how to get costs under control in a way that is still, you know, providing the best education for students, because you can't just talk about cost containment without talking about outcomes for students. And so I think those things need to be done in tandem.
Right. So those school budgets, nearly all school budgets have passed at this point, but there are still two that have not. Which ones are they? And have you spoken to any of the leaders from those districts?
Sure. So Barry had their third vote last week, and that failed. It actually passed in Barry City and failed in Barry Town, but the overall outcome was that it failed. And so they will not be able to do another vote before July 1st, which is this cutoff in which school districts will have to borrow money. They can borrow up to 87% of their current operating budget, and they must pay interest on that. So Barry is going to be in that position, they are going to have to borrow money. They will still try to pass a budget. I think they're probably going to wait until August. There's some concern. I talked to Michael Booten, who's the school board chair there. There's some concern if they try to do a vote in July, the turnout will be really low. So I think they're going to try to probably coincide the vote with the August primaries in order to make sure turnout's a little higher. It's still not decided, though. And then Enosburg-Richford, which is part of Franklin Northeast, they have their third budget vote tomorrow. And so I talked to Lynn Cota, the superintendent of that district. She's hopeful that it will pass because I think on the second try, they got a little closer to passing. But what's really important to note is Enosburg-Richford, for example, is one of the lowest spending districts in the state. Right. So the property tax increase is expected to be a lot lower than the average 14%. And Lynn Cota told me that there's some confusion among voters because you hear the governor saying, you know, a 14% tax increase is unacceptable. In her district, in her towns, it's a lot less. But it's hard to kind of get that message across to community members when you have from the Montpelier, you have kind of this rhetoric around how high the tax increases are.
So if you hear a school district whose budget took many votes to pass or still hasn't yet, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are expecting a very high property tax increase. In fact, it could be quite low.
In fact, most of the districts that took, you know, two, three, four votes to pass are some of the lowest spending, including Barry. And so, you know, I think Barry was only a 3-5% projected property tax increase. And it's the one that, you know, is probably the only one that's going to not meet this July 1st deadline. We don't know about Enosburg-Richford. But so I think that just kind of raises a lot of questions about equity here, right? Like, what is going on when you have the lowest spending districts still not able to pass budgets? And some of the ones that had, you know, higher than a 14% property tax increase, you know, they passed on the first try or the second try. I think it's also important just to think about, like, what are the effects of, you know, having a budget fail in a community multiple times? So, you know, I think there's a morale issue among, you know, staff, like when a budget keeps on failing, like, what does it say about how community members feel about our schools? I think there's a kind of erosion of trust that happens sometimes in communities where you know, the community members are not trusting the school as much as they used to, and feeling like the school isn't doing right by their children. And I also think, you know, having to lower budgets, you know, they're cutting positions, they're cutting things that are going to were there to benefit students. And so what does that mean for student learning when you have to keep cutting and cutting and cutting?
Allison, have you seen a year like this before?
No. I mean, I think this is a really, kind of, this was a doozy of a year. Yeah.
To put it lightly, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I think what's also important to know is that everyday teachers and, you know, administrators and paraprofessionals are going into school and doing the work, right? They're trying to support students the best they can. So I think sometimes we think about it from kind of the bird's eye view of, like, oh my gosh, what a disaster. But I also don't want to discount the fact that, you know, I think educators are working harder than ever to serve our students.
Yeah. Well, let's take a caller before we have to let you go, Allison. Margaret is in St. Albans. Margaret, you're on the air. Go ahead.
My question is simply this. A number of years ago, when basically Vermonters were forced into school consolidation, we were told that that was step one, and that step two was going to be the consolidation of superintendents, so that, you know, that we didn't have as many superintendents in the state of Vermont. And it seems, what happened to that? That seems like a cost-saving measure.
Thank you, Margaret. Allison?
I mean, I think that is something that is on the table as the discussion about the future of Vermont's education system, you know, continues and will, you know, really get going this summer. I think closing small schools, Vermont has many small schools, and I think many would argue that it's not cost effective to have, you know, dozens of schools that have under 100 kids. And also, you know, then you have administrators, you have costs to run the buildings. But it's a highly unpopular idea to close a school in a town. You know, if a town has to vote on whether to close their own school, they will never do that. So we see, you know, this year, Roxbury Village School is closing. And that's because the school board basically decided, like, their first budget failed, and they decided, like, this is the way we have to cut costs. And it was very unpopular, but Roxbury didn't have to vote in that case. And so the school board was able to kind of unilaterally say, we're going to close it. But I think this discussion around consolidation, around closing schools, around kind of, you know, making it so that there's not so many administrators, that is something that is definitely going to be on the table in this kind of latest round of discussions that's going to get underway.
Well, students certainly get a break this summer. Allison, I'm guessing you are not. There's lots of stories to follow here, lots of threads to untangle.
Sure.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Two school districts in Vermont have yet to pass their budgets, Barry and Enosburg-Richford. The deadline is now exactly a week away, July 1st. Schools that don't pass a budget will still be able to operate, of course, but the way that their district is funded is complicated, and there will be some concerns about paying the bills this summer without a budget. Brooke Olson-Farrell has had to lead a district through this type of situation before. She's the superintendent of Slate Valley Unified School District. They did pass its budget this year, but in 2020, they didn't pass a budget until August. And she joins us now. Brooke, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We're so glad to have you. And we are also joined in the studio today by Rebecca Tatishev. She's currently the principal of the Cabot School and is the incoming principal of U32 High School in Montpelier. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, you can join the conversation as well. How long did it take for your school district's budget to pass this year? How do you feel about where it ended up? You can call us at 800-639-2211 or send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, Brooke, your school budget passed this year, your school district's budget. We talked to you in early March for the first time, right after your budget failed on town meeting day, and a lot has happened between then and now. What changed in regards to your budget?
So we passed a budget last Tuesday on our fifth try. So it took us five times. And so our budget's about $500,000 less than what it was on town meeting day in March. But it took us a long time to get there. We had community members that actually were voting no because they wanted more spending. We had community members that wanted significantly less spending. The board really had to grapple with all of that and decide how to thread the needle on the best path forward, because we are the 15th lowest spending district out of 119 school districts. So they did not want to impact opportunities for students.
So where did that $500,000 in cuts come from?
So it ultimately came from positions, instructional assistants, as well as teaching positions. And ultimately, the reason they made the cuts in those areas were we were not receiving applicants for some of those positions. And that was due in part to the rhetoric that was happening in the community.
The you believe part of the reason that you weren't getting applicants for those positions was the rhetoric around the school district role?
Yes, and the funding challenges and just feeling like some people were just feeling like it wasn't a supportive community, even though we know that that's not necessarily the case here in Slate Valley.
Well, Rebecca, I'd love to hear what it was like at Cabot. Your community passed the budget on the first try. Is that right? But that hasn't always been the case.
Yeah. So I've been there for 4 years, and the first 2 years I was there, the budget did not pass on the first try. I think in the first year I was there, it took three times. The second year it was twice. And then last year, for the first time in at least 6 years, I believe, we passed on the first try. And a lot of that, and then instigated a real conversation about how to create sustainability in our school system and really pushing this idea that what we want for kids and the outcomes we want for kids really have to be the things that drive budget and drive our infrastructure decisions. And so we really started that conversation in June of last year and had some really hard conversations. Our budget was up this year significantly. And we also had a ballot measure to close the high school.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly how many times that has happened, but folks who have been there.
The fourth time in 11 years.
Yeah.
The community's voted on that.
Yep. And so that that conversation just creates a lot of discomfort in the community, right? And a lot of uncertainty. And so we really had to work through that this budget season. And I think what we saw was people come out in support of the school, but really in support of the work that young people are doing in the community and as learners, and as central to the way that citizens, their role as citizens.
Mm. Well, what I'm hearing from both of you is how fraught these conversations about school budgets, the role of a public school can be in these communities. Let's take some calls from folks now. We have Ellen in Middlebury on the line. Ellen, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, thank you for this discussion. I wanted to point out that a big elephant in the room of school costs is healthcare costs. Those are, you know, driving the school budgets up. It's not the only thing, but it's very significant. And we passed a bill back in 2011, which would have created, you know, a unified publicly financed healthcare system in the state and cut out the middlemen and given us a lot of cost control. But we never did it. And so it seems to me if we don't get back to the table with the legislature of getting back to Act 48, our bill that was passed in 2011, and getting some control on health care costs, which would ironically also improve access, so it's a win-win, mm-hmm. we're just going to see this fight between communities and schools because, you know, people are saying, and I'm not taking this position, but someone would say, well, I'm paying for health care for a teacher, but I don't have it, right? You know, someone might make that argument, right?
Right. Well, I would love to hear from Brooke Olson-Farrell about the role that rising health care costs play in the school budgets for Slate Valley Unified School District. Brooke?
Yeah, so for us, it adds hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, and it's really a cost that we don't have control over locally. So 16.4% was what healthcare went up last year, which translated into hundreds of thousands of dollars for us, in which, again, we didn't have control locally over that cost. Mm.
Rebecca, has this also been an issue in Cabot, these rising healthcare costs?
For sure. And I think that sometimes folks think we have a lot of control over lots of elements of our budget. And that's actually not the case. What we control in Cabot outside of like, you know, is actually really small in comparison to, I think, what folks perceive.
Do you think there are, what are the major things that you think folks believe that you have control over that you in fact don't?
I think in some ways, even the staffing conversation is a real impactful conversation. A couple of years ago, I finally said we can't actually run a school without the number of staff that we have. So staffing cuts aren't an option. And much of their salaries are controlled, right? We can't navigate or negotiate on an individualized basis.
And that's because of the union contract?
Because of the union contract, because of things like healthcare costs that are out of our control, because of special education funding or other costs that may impact. And so I think that one of the things that we just need to navigate is what schools actually are in their control and what maybe isn't.
Mm. Brooke, you mentioned that it took five votes for the school district's budget to pass. What did it feel like for you when you finally got word that the budget had passed?
I think many of us felt grateful and relieved at the same time because we had a lot of programs that were on hold. We really couldn't go into the school year or into the summer with planning around summer programming or staff professional development because the future was really uncertain. So I think for many of us in the district, we feel relieved.
Mm. And you're part of a small group of school leaders in the state that has led a district past this July 1st deadline when a school budget didn't pass. That was back in 2020 for you. Could you tell us a little bit about what you learned from that experience and maybe any advice that you might have for the two school districts that are facing down that deadline right now?
So, of course, 2020 was very different, right?
Yes.
We weren't operating in-person education at that time. So there were a lot of things that weren't costing us money over those summer months. We didn't have custodians in the school working on maintenance projects. There were a lot of things we weren't doing. We didn't have summer programming for students. So in a way, it wasn't as challenging to navigate. It was certainly challenging in figuring out how we were going to vote, all of those things, but it wasn't, as challenging to figure out how we were going to get student services or staff paid because we were under COVID shutdown. So, certainly going into this year, if we had approached July 1st without a budget, personally, as superintendent, I would be looking at what programs should we not be running over the summer in order to conserve funds to ensure that we had the funding for the regular school year when that got underway in August. So I think it's very different, those two scenarios.
What kind of programs run in the summer that might not be able to run without a past budget?
So for us, and this was actually impacted this time for us by not having a budget, as late as June 18th was when we finally got a past budget. We actually didn't end up running our middle school orientation camp. That's when we bring incoming seventh graders to the middle school campus for a week in July. It's usually the second week in July. So we ended up not running that this year and are instead going to do something at the beginning of the school year. But those are types of programs that could be impacted in these districts. Also, extra student support over the summer could be staff professional development. That's typically when we bring staff to the table and have new learning opportunities around instructional practices. All of those things would be impacted if you don't have a past budget by July 1st, definitely.
Mm. Let's take another call here. We have Randy in St. Albans on the line. Randy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, I want to touch base on what Margaret was speaking about, and then that lady, I don't remember her name, was talking about closing schools. I guess, Mike, I have a couple things here. Like, I have a 15-year-old daughter that just went into the ninth grade, and she can't even write her name in cursive. Like, what about all these iPads and the computers and the Chromebooks? Like, we're not even teaching our kids how to write their own name in cursive anymore. Like, would that help the spending budget? Like, I guess I'm a little out of line.
But. No. Sorry, I just want to clarify your question there, Randy. So you're concerned about certain skills that aren't getting taught to students anymore that were taught when you were in school. And how does that relate to the school budget issue?
The school budget is because we're spending all this money on Chromebooks and iPads and all this stuff. Isn't that tied in with our budget as well?
Mm, okay. Thank you, Randy. Rebecca Tatiche with the Cabot School and about to be U32 in East Montpelier. Thoughts on Randy's concern there?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I hear often from folks is this question about, like, what is happening? What do we want to invest in terms of student learning? And I think Cabot's a great example of how sort of we've worked to really clarify and align our work to the really what's been passed in Vermont legislation around flexible pathways, transferable skills, inclusive practices, proficiencies. Those are all the things that folks in industry are asking for. So things like, are students becoming critical thinkers? Are they becoming technology savvy, which is something that is really required in this particular day and age, both for career, college, sort of life citizenship readiness. And we've done that through project-based learning, through the work of, our students built a poetry trail, learning to write, also learning to build. Our students build an aquaponics system, learning to solve problems, learning to make sure that our kind of world is taken care of. And we see them as change makers and resources in the community. And so while that doesn't answer that question about cursive in particular or technology in particular, I think we are seeing industries that are asking young people to be prepared with really adaptive skills in an adaptive world. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Vermont legislation is actually requiring us to do as schools. And I would say the question we should be raising is, how is the budget supporting that?
Mm. And I'm glad you brought up that last point about the legislative requirements on schools, because we were talking earlier about what individual schools have control over and what they don't. And there are a lot of requirements put in place by the legislature that cost school districts money, right?
Absolutely. And a lot of those have to do with the ed quality standards, with things like Act 77 and personalized learning plans and proficiency-based learning. Those are all really great initiatives on the part of legislators to really ask and require schools to think about what are you teaching and in service of what. And so I think that is that kind of, when we look at budget and infrastructure and these big questions that we are really grappling within the state, we also need to look at how those are aligned to and speaking with these other legislative acts.
Mm. Well, Brooke, I'd also love for you to weigh in on our caller Randy's concern there about the cost of some of the programs and learning tools that schools provide to students now, everything from, you know, computers to tablets. Do those play a significant role in these hotly debated budgets?
They definitely play a role, a significant role, I'm not sure about. I think more the cost driver is really around mental health. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge cost driver in our school budgets. We are hiring more school-based clinicians, more school counselors, because of the mental health needs of our students. And that public education, it's an entitlement for students to receive those services. You know, students may go to the local designated agencies or community partners, and they can say, we have a waiting list. Schools can't say that. So that's a huge cost driver that can't be discounted in this conversation.
Mm. Brooke Olson-Farrell is the superintendent of Slate Valley Unified School District. Brooke, thank you so much for your time today. Oh, thank you, Brooke. And Rebecca Tatishev is our other guest, the principal of the Cabot School, as well as the incoming principal of U32 High School in East Montpelier. Thank you so much for your time, Rebecca, and best of luck in your new role.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
This year, the talk of the legislative session when it came to education was school budgets. But last year, it was childcare. Legislators passed a law known as Act 76. It'll pour an additional $120 million a year into the state's child care system to make it more affordable and more accessible. It'll be funded by a payroll tax, which goes into effect next week on July 1st. Joining us now is Allie Richards. She's the CEO of Let's Grow Kids, the advocacy organization that has been leading the push for more investment in early childhood education in Vermont. Allie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Michaela. It's great to be here with you.
So this payroll tax will be implemented on July 1st, and that's going to fund a lot of the meat and potatoes of Act 76. But in the past year, since Act 76 first went into effect, there have already been some changes. What happened since the law passed last session?
It's really just exciting to be here to talk with you about this, because you maybe saw a headline in the news a couple of weeks ago that said positive trend emerges 1 year after Vermont's historic child care law. So what that meant was, in the first quarter of this year, we had more child care programs open than close in Vermont. That's just a remarkable thing, right? I have to pause on that. It just shows you the depth of this crisis we're in as a state and a country. And here we are in Vermont wrangling it, right? It's the first time we saw more programs open than closed since we started tracking that data in 2018. And that's because of the public investment you just mentioned in Act 76. So what are we seeing? you know, first we saw stabilizing some $20 million rolled out last fall, stabilizing childcare, right? It's a fragile industry. It always has been. We're changing that here in Vermont.
I'm sorry, the $20 million that was rolled out, that's in the form of grants? How did that work?
Exactly, grants. And in fact, responsive grants, right? It was really an incredible job on behalf of the state, the Child Development Division, and under the Agency of Human Services. They got the $20 million out to childcare programs in this incredibly responsive, flexible way to really meet their needs. And it did exactly what it was supposed to do, is really stabilize that sector so we didn't lose a lot of childcare right as we're coming out of COVID, right at this fragile time for our economy. And it was actually even a mobile friendly application that took, you know, 5 minutes to do. So really incredible work and partnerships that really did what we hoped. And that's what we're starting to continue to see in this implementation, right? It's working. It's going well. It's very transparent. We're seeing things now in January, more money going to childcare programs so they can operate, right? We're seeing that in the form of increased benefits, new spaces, new childcare programs. This is what we know we need to have a sustainable childcare infrastructure. And then in April, you started seeing us tackle affordability with this law, right? So the first expansion for more Vermonters with childcare tuition assistance to help them pay for this childcare. By October, Michaela, we're going to see over 7,000 additional Vermont children and their families qualifying for reduced childcare costs. So that just gives you a sense of, you know, the phasing of this. And we're seeing just what we hoped: more childcare, more affordable childcare for more Vermonters, and wages for these early educators going up to really actually support a sustainable industry here in Vermont that's going to support our economy.
Where are the new childcare centers that have opened up since Act 76 passed?
They are all over the place, which is, again, incredible. You know, a couple examples in Cabot, that, and you just had someone on from Cabot in your last segment, right? That's, we just saw our first ever licensed childcare program open up in that town. That's incredible. And what we heard from business leaders in that area was it was a game changer. You know, their words, we're making an investment. It's working. You're starting to see that ripple effect. Another great example is in Swanton. We just saw a family childcare program use the public investment from Act 76 to convert to a center-based program. That tripled the childcare spaces for that community up north. Another great example, Michaela, I love to talk about is in Guildhall, because home-based providers are a key part of this. And it sounds like it's a national story coming up at one, too. You know, we are seeing in a rural place like Vermont, home-based childcare is absolutely a critical component of this story. You're bringing childcare to these towns that have never had childcare before. They're childcare deserts. So great example up in the Northeast Kingdom, you've got Guildhall. They have their first ever home-based, you know, program opening. It's really adding some vibrancy, you know, to that town for the families and the kids, and then for those employers in the area. So just a couple examples, but we're seeing it all across Vermont.
Well, I want to make sure we have some time to talk about the new payroll tax. It's going to pay for increased subsidies that the state then pays to childcare providers on parents' behalf to make their tuition payments cheaper. Tell us about the payroll tax. How much is it, and how is it changing income eligibility?
Great question. You know, the payroll tax supports all the progress that I just laid out being sustainable, right? So the beauty of childcare is we know how to fix it in Vermont. That's what Act 76 does. We know how to fix it as a country. We just haven't until now, you know, in our brave little state, had the courage to really push that public investment in. So what we did is, you know, we dug deep here together in Vermont. We came together across party lines to say, we know it's tough, but we're going to make this investment in childcare. And so this is a new payroll tax. It's known as the childcare contribution. It's less than half a percentage point, so 0.44%, split 75-25, employer share, employee share. And really what it does is it just creates a sustainable funding stream to do all the components I just laid out. more money to programs so they can grow their size, their capacity, more spaces, more programs, more, increase wages for early educators, which is the thing that constricts our access and our quality, across the system. And it helps expand income eligibility for Vermonters as well. So it's sort of all that money flows to do all those things. So, and just to put it in perspective for you, so in other words, as far as what is this contribution and what does it look like? I'm sure listeners are curious about that. So if you're making $60,000 a year, as an example, when this contribution goes into effect, you'll be contributing, $66 over the course of the year. So $66 a year if you're making $60,000. Just to give you a sense of the scope, Michaela, of what this looks like.
So there is an option, though, for employers to cover the full cost of this payroll tax rather than have a quarter paid by the employee. Do you have a sense of how many employers have opted to pay in full?
I don't have sort of a sense of percentage. As we know, we have a lot of small businesses that are really the backbone of Vermont. But I will tell you anecdotally, we're talking to employers all the time. They've been critical in passing this bill and helping craft the details and also even crafting the details of this revenue source, which really was how we were able to do this together in Vermont. And we're hearing actually quite a few employers who are choosing to pay the full contribution rather than passing that along. So really, I think some are saying, this is something we can do. It's a worthy contribution. And others are saying, actually, this is a competitive advantage for us if we pick this up. So lots of different perspective from employers. And as you say, we're definitely hearing from many who are choosing to do the full percentage, which is an option in how this has been structured.
Now, Allie, we have about a minute left here. Let's Grow Kids will sunset in 2025. That's always been the plan for the organization. What's one priority you really hope to accomplish before then?
It's a great question. So we owe it to Vermonters to make X76 work. So we really want to make sure implementation is going well. And a major part of doing that is really fully delivering on the promise of this. And that includes really supporting the workforce of early childhood educators. They are the heart and soul of this. Again, they are our ability to have quality, but also access. If you do not have enough workforce, you're not going to have enough childcare. So really, really supporting this workforce and really making sure that it's affordable for all Vermonters, regardless of your income. Those are our key priorities. And then we can sort of let the ecosystem take it on. And we have a lot of partners helping with wonderful data. It's very, we're really focused on accountability here, and we're seeing great partners on the ground. They'll be there past 2025 doing that really important work.
Allie Richards is the CEO of Let's Grow Kids, the advocacy organization that has been leading the push for more investment in early childhood education in Vermont. Allie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michaela. Always a pleasure to talk with you.